Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine, the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Last week, we were talking about the changing distribution of the ownership of property. Doesn't sound very exciting, but then it is actually crucial if you want to move from a tenancy to private tenancy to the security of a council house, or if you wish to move and own a property. These things are important to people. But I want to sort of broaden out and look today a little bit at the cultural impact of cities. And that's important because, of course, the overwhelming percentage of the population lived in cities. Now, I think it's fair to say that in the first half of the century, maybe despite, but you could say in reaction to the extent of urbanisation, there was a continuance of a sort of ruralism and idyll of the countryside that had developed in the late 19th century. It took a number of forms. It took one form was the desire to preserve rural spaces, to look after the rural heritage, which was an important theme and is to obviously look towards things like areas of outstanding natural beauty being designated, the formation of the National Trust, etc. There were cultural tropes, to use a hilarious phrase, which means everything and nothing. There were cultural tropes ranging from the music of Edward Elgar to the music of Ralph Vaughan Williams, the idylls of poetry about the countryside, nostalgic sort of fiction about the strength of rural community. All of these played a role. So indeed did a view of rural life, which was, as it were, transposed onto suburbia, which in a sense testified to the way in which many members of the elite, instead of wishing to live in houses on crescents and such like in the centres or near the centres of cities, instead wanted to live on the outskirts or beyond cities, maybe in, for example, Surrey, Stockbroker Belt, or the northern bit of Gosforth outside Newcastle, or Metroland, northwest of London, and maybe go in by train, but nevertheless pretend that they were living a rural life and maybe taking part in semi-rural activities, the cult of the golf club, for example, riding for particularly spouses and daughters. These were kind of part of a ruralism which took many manifestations but was strong. And, you know, one of my interests is the detective story. And of course, classically in the interwar period, the detective story often portrays a attractive view of the countryside. I mean, obviously people are getting murdered, but the backdrop, the context of this is an idea of rural calm, which is disrupted by the murder. And indeed, often the murder is something like, you know, a grand nephew up or an illegitimate child up from town to try and pursue an inheritance. Anyway, ruralism was strong. Ruralism was also political. It was very actively embraced in some respects by the conservatives of the first half of the 20th century. And you see that in a number of respects. You see the move of the Conservative Party, a hesitant move, a slow move, but the move of the Conservative Party towards protectionism, one of the defences of which being given was that it would protect the rural interest in agriculture in particular. You see the sort of cult of the countryside very much associated with Stanley Baldwin, loving to, be photographed against a five-bar gate, smoking a pipe and such like. And Philip Williamson has written very successfully about and ably about Baldwin's embrace of the countryside, a sort of political version of P.G. Woodhouse's Lord Emsworth with his pigs. And that was very much a key point of the national government of the 1930s, that in a way the countryside represented the truth of Britain, both of England, but also, for example, in the interest in the Scottish Highlands, the novels of John Buchan, Lord Tweedsmuir, in the 1930s, the idea that it represented the truth as against to rootless cosmopolitans and Bolsheviks, as they referred to them, in urban areas. And I think that that was an important antithesis. Now, the fact is that many people that bought into the account of ruralism were urban. Indeed, again, looking at long-term trends, the fascination of urbanites with going on walking holidays in the countryside, joining the Youth Hostelling Association, joining the Boy Scouts and the Girl Guides, who tended to transport themselves, turning English commons into the South African veldt where Lord Baden-Powell had made his reputation. All of this was very important. And in the 1950s, there was, in a way, a resurgence of that cultural theme. Now, just to remind listeners, there'd been a Labour governments, I should say, from 1945 to 1951, of Clement Attlee. And those, I think it's fair to say, had very much been urban in their intentions and their appearance, and of course had stamped the town on the countryside with the beginnings of construction of state-backed new towns. And I think it's fair to say, and also, the rural areas, like everybody else, was under state control, the man from the ministry, which inevitably was a urban character. Now, Conservative governments that came in from 1951 to 1964 under four successive prime ministers, Churchill till 55, Eden from 55 to 57, Macmillan from 57 to 63, and Hume from 63 to 64, they were all different in a way. They were not identical. And there was a kind of modernizing concept there, which, seen with, for example, the 1955 railway plan and, diesel trains, civil nuclear power, the corporatism supported by Macmillan and his attempt to join the European Economic Community, the predecessor of the European Union. But at the same time, there was also a very much a kind of county background to a lot of the Conservative Party of that period. All of those prime ministers were from either Eton or Harrow, as was indeed a lot of the cabinet and was a lot of the parliamentary party. People went away in that social milieu, the country house weekends. They went shooting in the summer. Many of them did not make a habit of going abroad. I mean, Duncan Sands, for example, a prominent Tory, was sort of quite proud of, his inclinations for holidays were, sort of maybe going shooting in the north or shooting in Scotland. And there was, again, as I've said, this kind of ruralism, people dressing around in tweeds or tartans, etc., etc., etc. Now that, I think it is fair to say, ceased to have weight in the 1960s. And in the 1960s, you instead get a very different urban cultural pulse, if you like. So alongside what we were talking about last time, the urban so-called renewal of town centre, so-called rebuilding, there was this cultural beat pulse towards the north of England, not least with what was known as the Mersey Beat. And the key change was the response to the Beatles, which were a northern popular group, pop music, who with their debut single, Love Me Do, released in October 1962, set this Mersey beat, Liverpool, their home city, was on the Mersey, and who offered working class experience, urban experience. It wasn't for, as it were, the young ploughman, both prominence and sound. Pop music challenged the received pronunciation of the English language, providing a regional difference that was taken up by the BBC, where the importance of conformity in diction, style and tone, and indeed the clothes you wore, declined from the 1960s. Lord Reith would increasingly have not recognised the BBC, though I seem to remember as a young person, as I was young, David Jacobs, I think, doing the pop music programme in which he wore, you know, I think I seem to remember at least initially a dinner jacket, but that swiftly went. The film director, Guy Hamilton, later noted, and Guy Hamilton's famous, of course, for being one of the film directors of the Bond franchise, quote, "The combination of angry young men, Michael Caine, who of course did the lead in, or the joint lead in Zulu in 1964 in a very working class argot, and the Beatles killed the leading men who had all spoken with Oxford accents. Unless you had a Brummie accent," Brummie was Birmingham, "forget it. I think the Beatles and the pop scene in general had a major influence on the cinema at this time." And you can think of iconic films of that kind of urban English experience. I mean, Michael Caine's a good example, with Alfie very much being set in London, or Get Carter being an absolutely brilliant account of Newcastle. And Michael Caine, in the beginning of Get Carter, of course, goes from London to Newcastle, but he goes on a train, which amazingly enough is moving with some speed. And as it were, the countryside isn't there, and it's certainly not being enjoyed by him, or he has no interest in it. He's going from one city to another city, as if that movement defines experience, as indeed it does for him. And I think, you know, Get Carter, I think you could fairly say that the most rural scene is the country house where the party is held, presided over by John Osborne, the playwright. And that it is the country house which is seedy and degenerate. It's quite an interesting view that. Other groups and performers also came from Liverpool, including, for example, Cilla Black, no relation. Indeed, popular music lent itself to female as well as male performers. Lulu, of course, from Scotland. If the bands, with their emphasis on electric guitars, were very much male preserves, many of the singers were women. All of them presented urban experience. Interest in Liverpool was also shown by another cult, football, of course, but also by the popularity of the Liverbirds, a television sitcom set there that began in 1969 and made life in Liverpool, among ordinary people, its central theme. This was a North very different to the urban working class one depicted by L.S. Lowry, as in his football painting Going to the Match of 1953 and his Lancashire League cricket match painted between 1964 and 1969. Those had been a account of the North, which was very much the sort of grim up North account in which literally small men in his paintings went to or from things like factories. The Liverbirds were offering something very different. Now, in practice, in the context of Beatlemania, which struck in 1963-4, the Beatles actually went south. They went London and became a global as well as a national product. They set the sound of the 60s. Their broadcast of All You Need Is Love in 1967 transmitted to 26 countries and was seen by about 400 million people. Thanks largely to the Beatles, popular music became a British industry, replacing the American rock and roll of the 50s. And this was urban popular music. There was no room for a sort of rural kitsch. This was very, very, very urban. The Beatles, or in the way they were perceived, contributed powerfully to the idea of a new Britain, an idea that was strong in the mid-60s. This idea was linked to the policies advocated by the Labour Party, which governed the country from 1964 to 1970, and which entitled 1964 General Election Manifesto, The New Britain. Labour introduced a range of social legislation, and which was in many senses deliberately presented, as in the legalisation of homosexuality between consenting adults, of abortion, or the abolition of capital punishment, all of which were very much presented as an attempt to change the country. This idea was related to a range of cultural and product developments, all urban, including the new clothes fashioned, pioneered in Carnaby Street in London, and the modern design themes often related to new technology, such as the supersonic Concorde aircraft, or, again in 1964, the Post Office Tower in London. Harold Wilson, a northerner, a Yorkshireman who cultivated his image as a northerner, hilariously so, of course, he actually liked smoking cigars, but he liked to be photographed smoking a pipe. And he also went south, ensuring that the Beatles were given honours. The mid-60s saw a cycle of swinging London films, so-called, including Darling in 1965 and Blow Up in the same year, both of which examined the morals and mores of a permissive society, in which the role of family values and the churches were largely redundant. For Alfie, in the 1966 film of that name, which was again set in London, women, clothes and cars were commodities that proved one could get on in the world without the privileges of birth and education. And on a national scale, supermarkets provided new anonymous shopping experiences and spaces, and at this stage were mostly within towns rather than outside them. Being within towns, of course, it wasn't necessary for people to have cars in order to shop at them. And a lot of people didn't have the use of a car. So in families where there was generally one car, the man would often take the car to commute. The woman would often do the shopping and would not have access to a car, would use a bus. This, for example, you know, statistics on Birmingham indicate this very much the practice. And therefore, you need your supermarket in the town. Now, this new world was to be hit hard by financial and economic crises from 1967. While already a rising degree of disturbance in towns was increasingly apparent. For example, the Daily Telegraph of the 21st of July, 69, I noticed, reported from St. Ives, not generally seen as the centre of urban discontent, where a petition had called for, quote, tighter vagrancy laws to rid the town of beatniks. And again, quote, a group of people tried to break into a derelict building occupied by beatniks. And separately, that more than 300 angry people staged a sit-down protest outside Lee Park Gardens in Havant in Hampshire yesterday, quote, over the goaling of six parents who a week ago demonstrated against a proposed 6B increase in admission to the charges to the park, which belonged to Portsmouth Council. All sorts of, you know, I mean, it's worth bearing in mind, people will always tell you about, you know, the 60s as if everybody was taking part in some sort of drugs and, you know, political radicalism. It's worth bearing in mind that whether people trying to beat up beatniks in St. Ives or people demonstrating against Portsmouth Council for putting up admission charges to parks, that it's a very varied decade. And of course, It's a decade in which key figures are people like the American evangelist who comes to London, Billy Graham, or for that matter, hobbies like going on, like, for example, train spotting. So you've got a world which you shouldn't think of as just defined in terms of the evenement of 1968. The town as a troubling environment containing lawless groups was scarcely new, but the idea was readily transposed onto anxieties about new cultural and social trends, while also being revived by them. In an urban society, however, this attitude tended to be focused on sections of towns rather than the town itself, although it was an element that encouraged suburbanization. So, for example, people moving out of the East End of London to suburbs such as Edgware or Cock Fosters, and the same sort of practice elsewhere in other cities. Urban rioting was small scale prior to 1981. Obviously, there were riots. The 1958 Notting Hill riot was, for example, very unpleasant indeed, linked to tensions over immigration. But I think it's fair to say that there was nothing on the scale of what were in this half of the century, nothing on the scale of what was to happen in 1981. Linked to this, major changes in urban society were more generally national. These included the decline in the number of living-in servants in the first two-thirds of the century, followed by a rise as living-out servants expanded greatly. Now, they weren't generally called servants, which is a hilarious thing. I mean, lots of shock, horror, Labour prominent figures have servants today, but they're not called servants. They're called cleaners or gardeners or carers. Which is one of the ways that people deal with the situation. While an increase in jobs for full-time professional women in turn led to the employment of more help. The more widespread expansion of the service economy focused on towns and provided more employment for women. Female employment was very much concentrated on towns. Within that more general context, the success of individual towns varied greatly, depending on their economy and on the economy of the surrounding regions. For example, the Mersey Docks and Harbour Board hit serious problems in the early 1970s, part of the longer-term decline of Liverpool. Liverpool, in other words, in the 60s was very much seen as the future. The Labour government shoehorned a car factory in under sort of regional development, etc., etc. By the early 70s, it was quite clear that it was in fact in serious problems. Such factors were also pertinent within towns. So it's not just towns as a whole, but also individual areas of towns, with the appeal of housing stock and the association of neighbourhoods both particularly important in how some areas did better than others. For example, in 1987, in the Newcastle wards, the rates of unemployment ranged from 8.9% in Westerhope to 36% in West City, an area affected by deindustrialization. You know, the Armstrong Works had been there, etc. In fact, since then, a lot of that part of the city was a lot of the old housing was sort of levelled by in supposed slum clearance. These issues, problems, and changes encouraged a very varied depiction of urban life. It included responses that scarcely matched homilies, whether those of Victoriana, municipal liberalism, welfare state socialism, or Thatcherite effort. All of those were on offer, but the interesting aspect is that a lot of the public weren't interested in any of these. Till Death Us Do Part, which ran from 1965 to 1975, an unsentimental account of the London East End, which was very popular and was much followed, Was a very interesting commentary on first Harold Wilson, then on Edward Heath, and then on Harold Wilson again. And Alf Garnett, the central character, was quite happy to take his pipe out of his mouth and to expostulate about these politicians. It was followed by Bread, a television series that ran for more than 70 episodes from 1986 and whose audience grew to over 20 million people. A lot of people. I mean, that's a lot of people for British listening. This sympathetically depicted a Liverpool family whose younger members were mostly unemployed and ready to cheat the social security system. That was to be followed by The Royal Family, R-O-Y-L-E, a sitcom about a television-fixated family living in a Manchester council house, which ran for three series. The television police series, The Sweeney, 1975-8, brought to an abrupt end the cosy image of the kind-hearted London policeman seen in Dixon of Dock Green, which had gone on from 55 to 76, a comforting series much at variance with the far darker reality of crime and policing, notably corruption. John Thorne in The Sweeney was very different to the cerebral figure he played as Morse in the television series of that name. He was, in fact, much more of a, you know, smash in and beat up the villains. The very first Morse shows that when he breaks up some gangsters in Jericho, an area of Oxford, but then he switches. At the same time, there was much regional, local, and social variation. So in 1976, Johnny Rotten and the Sex Pistols, a radical band, made their first appearance outside London, playing in a nightclub in Northallerton, an interesting choice, a small, quiet Yorkshire town, the county town of North Yorkshire. The noise and the lyrics didn't go down well, and much of the audience promptly left. Metropolitan culture was of little interest in much of the country. And indeed, that remains the case. What is really striking repeatedly is the disjunction between metropolitan attitudes, mores and cultural assumptions, and those of the rest of the country. However, much more seriously, many towns that had been part of the workshop of the world were now in grave difficulties, in part urban wastelands, such as that Mrs. Thatcher was photographed visiting on Teesside in September 1987. It was not only that unemployment was highest in traditional mining and heavy industrial areas, but also that the highest expenditure per head on income support and the greatest percentage of households with a low weekly income were highest in these areas. Interestingly enough, you might say, if you were to watch the television or things about the miners' strike, you might assume that the working class didn't like Mrs. Thatcher. In fact, urban support for Thatcher reflected socioeconomic factors, not least divisions within the working class. So in 1987, in her last election, the Conservatives won key marginal seats in the Midlands, unlike in the Northeast with its heavily unionised, highly unionised heavy industry. The Full Monty, 1997, a comedy film set in Sheffield, had as its bleak background unemployment and urban decay. And its Sheffield was indeed affected by international competition in its traditional metallurgy, you know, cutlery production most famously. From the perspective of a more mobile society, American viewers expressed surprise that the unemployed did move to areas of greater opportunity, although the nature of the housing market makes that more difficult in England than in America. For the English, the Full Monty was another version of the grim up north approach, prevalent from the 19th century and more especially 1930s, George Orwell Road to Wigan Pier, for example, as well as the focus on neighbourhood that was significant to the view of urban living. Graham, have you got any observations at this point?
Well, thank you, Jeremy. I'm very struck by particularly some of the points you're making in the
first half of what you're saying about the sense of vim and vigour that the towns and cities of England, the sense of swagger almost that they portrayed themselves as having, you know, in the early mid-60s, towns and cities where the future countryside was the jaded past. And then we move forward to the late 70s and early 80s, where a lot of these towns and cities, particularly in the north of England, are really struggling, albeit that the picture is not uniform. And I wonder to what extent the optimism in the 60s, particularly in northern places like Manchester and Newcastle, was more spin than reality. Actually, were fundamentally the skids already on during this period, but, you know, bright new buildings gave the impression that things were going to be a beautifully planned future. One thinks, of course, of T. Dan Smith knocking down large parts of Newcastle. And then, you know, by the 80s, we can see these buildings are awful, falling to bit, gym crack construction. Is this seems fair, or actually was there something about the economy of the 1960s which did underpin a real sense of kind of swinging northern towns where the future was hopeful?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question. I think we need to disaggregate it. First of all, obviously there was a lot of spin. I mean, there is spin in all political parties and all political movements, but I think those who call themselves progressives, and the Labour Party very much was in that mould, are more inclined to spin because they're more inclined to proclaim that they are the future and that they have brought already the future to people. So that inherently is a more spin proposal than one on continuity. So yes, and I don't think there's any doubt that spin was played a big role. And the subtext you asked that there was, were all the people taken in? The answer was no. There was a lot of scepticism about what was going on. And as you correctly say, I mean, you referred to corruption in the northeast of England. As you correctly say, there were many people that were well aware that the Labour Party, with its progressivism, also stood for jobs for the boys, or in Wales, the boyos. But you asked then a separate question, if you don't mind me saying, which is the nature of the economy in the 1960s. And I think it's fair to say, first of all, that there are differences of opinion. There is the opinion that the economy was, you know, performing reasonably well till either the 70s or the 80s. You can see aspects of that in the work of David Edgerton, for example. There is also the argument that the economy was already in serious difficulties because trade unionism in the 50s had ensured, and the failure of the Conservative government, it's sometimes argued, to stop it, to restrict it, which is a critique that the Thatcherite commentators direct against One Nation Conservatives, had helped to make a lot of British industry uncompetitive. So there's that argument. I think one can look at this in two separate ways. They're not incompatible propositions. One proposition would be that the economy continued to grow, which is what you would expect. I mean, the spread of more advanced manufacturing techniques, most of them coming in from the United States, the general buoyancy of Western Europe as a market, more efficient agriculture, meaning you could produce food without such a large cost in manpower or money, specific changes in particular industries, not least electrical engineering. All of those lead to growth, and yet at the same time, the relative position of the British economy is deteriorating. So let me give you an obvious instance. Until 1959, Britain was the largest builder of ships. And after 1959, that was Japan. and Britain's position was relative position was relative was rapidly to decline, as indeed in shipbuilding its absolute position declined. I think it's fair to say the relative position of Britain in motor car production or in aero space also declined. So my own view, for what it is worth, is that the idea that that Britain was at the cutting edge, whether that idea was going to be embraced by Macmillan with his corporatism in the beginning of the 60s, very end of the 50s, or Wilson with the so-called white heat of technology in the Department of Economic Affairs, I think they were both deeply flawed. And the central mistake they made, and we can see that central mistake still to this day, is the idea that the government and central provision and central control is the best way to get growth from an economy. And in fact, it tends to be the most sclerotic and often the most inefficient. You can see, for example, the wonderful investment of HS2 as an example today. So I think, and you might well argue that they would have anyway been in difficulties because of economic change, but you might well argue that nationalized control over both coal production and the railways were not actually conducive to their success. I mean, obviously, people will have differing viewpoints on this. So I would argue that there was a lot that was deeply flawed about the British economy, but that the spin was strongly there. And that was why devaluation in 1967 was such a shock.
Well, one last question. I think we've got hopefully time for one last question. And again, it's about the cultural aspects, particularly a cultural phenomenon that began in 1960, which is to say Coronation Street. And it's a slightly counterfactual question here, but I just wonder, you know, the portrayal of Manchester in Coronation Street then, as indeed later, is very much a traditional working class Manchester. I wonder if Coronation Street had started perhaps 5 years later in the mid-60s, it would have been a slightly more kind of swinging take on things, you know, a bit more like the Liverbirds did for Liverpool at the end of the decade.
I think you're absolutely right. I don't disagree with that for a second. I think the subtext, which is interesting, is although there were some middle-class soaps, essentially the social politics of culture was moving very much in a towards urban norms and the idea that everybody who was true was working class. And, you know, you get the absurdity that we were to come to with, you know, people like John Prescott, you know, Deputy Prime Minister, owner of a lot of wealth, cars, etc., presenting himself as working class. So I think that there was a very significant change in the presentation of identity. So culture is in part about, it's about all sorts of things. You can listen to Fidelio without having to worry about identity or go and, you know, but an aspect of it is the way in which through seeing things, plays, television, whatever, people have or are encouraged to have or feel embarrassed if they don't have a set of values and identities. And those, I think, in the 60s became much more aggressively urban. I mean, obviously, you know, the kitchen sink dramas are a good example of that. And the idea being that that's what you ought to go and see. You shouldn't go and see, you know, a kind of play about social manners and that such like, and that, you know, this represents quite a major change. You should be going to see Alan Sillitoe or the latest John Osborne or go and see Waiting for Godot or this sort of thing.
Yes, yeah, so the kind of no-coward Terence Rattigan world was out.
Yes.
Yeah.
But of course, actually, tell that to Northallerton.
Yes, indeed. Well, they're back now, I'm pleased to say. But we will have to leave it there. Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed for taking us through the cultural, but also many of the political and economic aspects of the English tan in the between the 60s and 80s. And we will continue this theme next time. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.